Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this very last day of May, the 31st. Yesterday was Memorial Day, so we're going to do an all things political today. We'll have two guests with us. We'll do a state focus and a national focus. Sean Johnson joining us the first part of the program, Wisconsin Public Radio's state government reporter. Later, Craig Gilbert will join us, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we'll be welcoming your phone calls. We have many issues to talk about, a lot going on in the state, of course. And nationally, we'll be looking at presidential races and the debt ceiling limit and the special election in upstate New York, where the Democrats won in a heavily Republican district, a result of Medicare. We'll talk about that. And here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Hello, Sean. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Joanne Kloppenburg is expected to give a press conference at 11 o'clock today. Do you know what's up?
Not with 100% certainty, no, but this is the last day that she has to decide whether she wants to accept the results of the statewide recount in her race with Justice David Prosser, and the results of those recount showed Prosser up by about 7,000 votes, or she can challenge it in court. And so, either of those options would be what she'd be announcing today. Normally, when you hold a press conference to announce something, you're announcing news, though, so it's possible that she could be announcing she wants to go the court challenge route, but I don't know for sure.
Well, we'll find out very soon, and you'll be on the story, I'm sure. One of the stories that broke over the weekend, explain this to me, the controversial jobs fund now, money going to insurance companies. Can you explain that to me?
The jobs fund now, is that the... I assume you're talking about the plan that... that they're debating right now.
Yes.
That would deal with venture capital funds.
Yes.
That's something that's, I think, that lawmakers are still grappling with, and it's something that's been tried in other states. But it's been met with pretty significant, I guess, opposition so far. It's just a proposal at this point. But it would basically have the state taking on risk for venture capital funds, but wouldn't be able to reap the reward if the venture capital investments turned out well. So it's sort of designed to prime the pump, but there's no guarantee that'll work. And if it does, it's something where the risk is borne by the state, but not necessarily the rewards.
The Journal Sentinel Sunday, it was a holiday yesterday, said that the governor is planning substantial changes to this bill, derided by some lawmakers as a dubious giveaway and crony capitalism benefiting insurance companies. Do you think that's an indication that he's backing away from it pretty fully? Did it get roundly criticized?
Well, it's not one of those that's just being criticized by Democrats. It's something where... For example, very conservative Republican Senator Glenn Grothman has come out and called it a giveaway. And, if you assume that he represents a voting bloc in the legislature, the governor has to listen to his concerns if he wants anything like this to get through there.
There are some changes to things along the way here, maybe because people are facing recall elections and they're concerned about it. First, let's talk about those recall elections. I'm a little confused. Is July 12th set for three of the elections, or is that all up in the air now?
July 12th, I don't believe July 12th is set in stone at this point. So last week, the Government Accountability Board met and basically signed off on recommendations from the staff there that recalls move forward and that the petitions were sufficient to recall Senators Dan Kopanky, Randy Hopper, and Luther Olson. Those are all Republican senators. And the board's action basically said that there were, said that there were more than enough signatures for each of those lawmakers. They're meeting today and are likely to say the same thing about Republican Senator Coles, Harsdorf, and potentially Darling, but they're holding off on action. They were scheduled to certify or discuss the recall petitions against six senators today. They're only discussing three because they said there's significant legal issues raised by the petitions for the other three. And so that puts that off until at least next week. And they said that may put off that July 12th election date, especially if you want to have every recall election held on the same date.
Right. So it could put it off how long?
Don't know. I mean, I think they have they're obligated by, you know, some constitutional concerns that they need to get these moving as quickly as they can. But if they end up delaying it and then their decision gets challenged in court, for example, that could end up delaying it for a little longer. We're sort of in uncharted territory here, so I don't know what that would mean exactly for when these things would get held, but they could be put off beyond that July 12th date or not. You could end up having three or nine of them on July 12th.
Mm-hmm. What more are you hearing about possible candidates for the Senate seat being vacated by Herb Kohl?
For Herb Kohl, it's still up in the air on both sides at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you have opportunities like this don't come along very often, an open Senate seat.
Right.
And so, and it's open with enough time that somebody who's not, you know, a multimillionaire has a plausible chance of getting in and forming a campaign and raising the resources they need to win an election here. And so you have a lot of people still thinking about it. The big name that's being thrown out there for Republicans right now is former Governor Tommy Thompson. But that's, you've sort of seen a polarization among the Republican electorate here, at least among the activists over there. And you have the National Club for Growth going after Thompson and saying that he supported Obamacare, that, you know, if because he supported that, there's no way you can support him in a Republican primary for U.S. Senate. And so that's opened the door for other candidates like former State Senator Ted Kanivas. The leaders of the state legislature, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, his brother, Assembly Speaker Jeff Fitzgerald, are both mulling, you know, whether or not to get in the race. It's something that's a possibility for them, especially if Tommy doesn't get in. So that's, you know, a few of the names being tossed around over there. Also Mark Newman, who ran for governor last year, former congressman. On the Democratic side, a lot of it likely hinges on what Russ Feingold decides, but regardless of that, Congresswoman Tammy Baldwin has indicated a pretty strong interest in getting into the race on the Democratic side. And you know, you've heard other names thrown out there that that you would expect to get thrown out for a race like this, Congressman Ron Kind, for example. But Baldwin's shown a pretty strong interest. If Feingold were to, you know, say that he wants to run, though, he's definitely got the biggest name recognition statewide and could mount a statewide campaign pretty easily.
Has he said to anybody that he might be interested? How are we getting that name?
You know, if you just read the quotes from his former staff or people that are close to him, it's not, you're not, they don't come across as a strong signal that he really wants to jump in, at least at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're trying to read the tea leaves in that way, it doesn't look like he wants to be a candidate for this seat. He's got a lot of time. You know, that could change. But you also have this issue where Democrats, if they were able to get the, you know, more than a half million signatures they'd need in a 60-day period, you know, come later this year and early next year, they could potentially force a recall election of the governor. And if they were to do that, and there's, you know, nothing saying that they could, that's definitely a high hurdle. But if they were, you run into a situation there where they would need a candidate with strong statewide name recognition to run a race like that almost immediately, because the campaign would be run in such a short time span. And so the list isn't that long for Democrats at this point. You sort of have Russ Feingold and,
right,
you know, Tom Barrett, mayor of Milwaukee, who said he's not interested in running for U.S. Senate, but has given, you know, hints that if a recall election were held, that he'd be willing to jump in for that.
What a state, isn't it? Isn't it, something
really is.
All that's going on?
This year and next are just going to be crazy.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to this because it has national ramifications as well. When you brought up this National Club for Growth and really giving disparaging remarks about Tommy Thompson, it seems to me as though we're in this state of consternation in the state because of politics that may be more extreme than most people want, and that the Republicans have to be looking both on a national level and on a state level at people who will be elected and people who won't be causing a whole lot of turmoil. Tommy Thompson, people keep saying, I don't know if you think this is true or not, would probably be more electable because he's more moderate than some more extreme Republicans.
Well, if you just look at his electoral record, it's, sterling. He, not only won election to governor four times, but won it convincingly in most of those elections. And at least back in that time, he fit the mold of, what you would call a moderate. And, he's not necessarily embracing that moderate term right now. He's talking about the conservative accomplishments he had while he was in governor. When it comes to the state's W-2 program, for example, stuff like that, or the qualified economic offer limits. It was a collective bargaining limit in its own right that was put on teachers during the Thompson administration. Those are types of accomplishments he's highlighting right now. It is maybe sort of a snapshot of where the Republican Party is right now, where somebody like Thompson, who's very possibly electable on a statewide basis, isn't necessarily what the party base wants in its candidates right now.
Mm-hmm.
And Wisconsin really is in the thick of it nationally in so many ways. I mean, that Senate seat could potentially be one of the Senate seats that decides control of the U.S. Senate next year. You've got the, I imagine you'll talk about this more in the next half hour, but Paul Ryan's Medicare plan is definitely sparked off a national discussion and is likely to be fodder for elections going into next year. Then in Wisconsin, you have the governor's collective bargaining plan, which has made Wisconsin a national battleground in another way. And definitely for unions, they're focusing a lot of energy, a lot of resources on these recall elections and potentially, in a race for Walker's seat, because they want to send a message that this isn't something you can just do. You can't just pull the plug on these collective bargaining rights that have been around for years.
Yeah. What's going to be the final version of concealed carry?
I don't know, but at this point, the version that's passed committee is pretty wide open in terms of who would be able to carry a concealed weapon. It's definitely more open than the versions that passed when Governor Jim Doyle was here and the versions that he vetoed when he was governor, which had some type of a permitting process and some type of training, background checks. That's all gone from this proposal, and it's what advocates call constitutional carry. And they say because concealed carry or the right to carry weapons is enshrined in the Constitution, you don't need those other things. That's essentially you asking the government for a right that you already have. If you decide that to have a concealed carry law, you have to have permitting and you have to have training. And so the version that passed committee right now doesn't have those. And, you could carry a gun in a number of different places. You wouldn't have to have a single hour of training to carry a concealed weapon. I don't know if that has the support of the full legislature, but the fact that it passed the Senate committee is pretty significant, and the fact that the governor hasn't ruled out signing a bill like that is pretty significant, and certainly it could happen this session.
Not unheard of. What if you're rip-roaring drunk and you pull out your gun and in the heat of an argument, you shoot it? Would there be penalties for using a gun under the influence of alcohol?
There's nothing in the bill right now that says you can't use a gun if you've been drinking. And that's an issue where Milwaukee Mayor Barrett has come out and said, look, I don't favor the bill in principle, but if you're going to make one change to it, let's have absolute sobriety for carrying guns, which would say that if you've been drinking, then your concealed carry rights are waived. Basically, you can't carry a concealed weapon while you've been drinking. But as it stands right now, there's no such restriction on the bill that passed a Senate committee.
Let's welcome phone call. Sean Johnson is our guest the first half hour of the program, and we're welcoming calls at 800-486-8655. We're doing Tuesday All Things Political because we missed yesterday's due to Memorial Day. Craig Gilbert will join us the second half hour, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Here's the phone number. A lot to be talking about. Joanne Kloppenburg is going to give an announcement. We don't know what it's going to be. It's only about a 2.5 hours away, but would you like to see her challenge this vote or accept the recount as is? What about people who will run for Senate? Who would you like to see run? Concealed carry, we've talked about that. And there are just so many issues in the news in the state. So jump on in. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour, a documentary filmmaker who's done a wonderful film about people over 90 and loving it, not only loving it, but doing significant things, even at the age of 100. We'll speak with the filmmaker and with one of the well over 90-year-olds. If you want some true inspiration as you get older, as we all are, our number two is for you. 800-486-8655. Couple lines are open. Sean Johnson is our guest, Wisconsin Public Radio's state government reporter. And we start our calls with Michael from Stevens Point. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
I'm real good.
Good.
I guess I'm just confused on how the votes have been retallied, and Joanne Kloppenburg can still contest the vote. I guess I don't understand. I guess I just don't understand how that is. If it can be explained on how it can still go on yet that she can contest it.
All right, we don't know if she will or not, but on what basis would she do so? Do you imagine, Sean?
She's talked about finding anomalies in the recount process. That the recount process has exposed anomalies. So, you know, if she were to seize on one of those, and where the people in charge of the recount basically saw what she saw as anomaly and ignored it or counted those about votes toward David Prosser when she thought that they shouldn't have been, she can focus on those in a court filing and basically try her luck before before a judicial panel where she says, this is how it should have been handled. It wasn't handled this way. The law is on my side, and basically give it a try in the court that way. So everything in this recount process is documented to the T. I mean, they're really told to document everything. And so there's an extensive record for everything that happened here. So if there's a legal challenge, I imagine they will be pouring into various pieces of that and pointing out issues that the Kloppenburg campaign felt were not handled properly.
It was significant. Somebody did a breakdown of how the state voted. And the election, Waukesha, and I guess this has been true for many elections, really is just so solidly Republican right now. It gave Prosser the vote, didn't it?
Yeah, the base for both parties really turned out for this election. The governor made a lot of discussion about Dane County being Dane County versus everyone else as far as the results of this election, and that's what it showed. But really, if you balance it out, Dane and then the three-county block of Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington counties in southeast Wisconsin really balance each other out. In fact, after those Brookfield votes came in Waukesha, that three-county region outpolled Dane County. It's solidly red in the same way that Dane County is solidly blue. Funny thing is, though, as far as the Senate recall campaigns, that those counties won't really have a big say in what happens in the state Senate recall campaigns here, because they're in other parts of the state that aren't so solidly red or blue for the most part. That was significant in a race like this for the state Supreme Court. A statewide race with relatively low turnout wouldn't be so significant for the races this summer.
Let's go to Jude. Thanks for the call, Michael. Let's go to Jude in River Falls. Hi, Jude.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
I want to make a comment about the carry conceal. I'm a card-carrying member of the NRA, but I think there should be some regulations, especially the alcohol one, because even the NRA will tell you alcohol and guns don't mix. And I think that's one reason the NRA is one of the reasons why Walker won was because of the NRA and because the Democrats are anti-gun. And personally, I would vote against Walker, but I'm not articulating this very well. I like the fact that they're going to pass the carry conceal, but I think there should be regulations. And if the Democrats would actually be more pro-gun, they could actually win a lot of the races, because up here in Wisconsin, everybody wants to hunt and fish and stuff like that, and NRA does have quite a bit of influence.
Sean?
A lot of Democrats voted for the concealed carry that was up in the legislature last time around that passed and that was then vetoed by the governor. There's a decent chance that even if it's constitutional carry, actually we know that if it's constitutional carry, at least one Democratic senator, Jim Holprin, up in northern Wisconsin, will vote for this bill. So it's not something where it's going to get most of its votes from Republicans, but there are Democrats from rural parts of the state that definitely are backers of gun rights and listening to their constituents on the issue as best they feel like they can. The NRA is backing basically whatever passes at this point. And so they've thrown their support behind the bill that has a permitting process. They've thrown their support by the bill that is no permitting process, that's wide open, that passed the committee. And in the past, they've thrown their support behind bills that require training and are much more restrictive. But they're not pushing that in this political climate because they can get a whole lot more given the makeup of the legislature.
We haven't talked about the voter ID bill. I'd like to before we move to national news soon. What effect is it going to have, do you think, on voting in the state of Wisconsin? And are the changes substantial? Are we going to need to be educated on this?
Yeah, I mean, they're substantial. And it is a shift away from, even if it's practically speaking, most people have IDs, and most people won't have an issue when they go to vote. They'll have to show an ID, and for the majority of people, it won't have an effect. But it is a shift in what Wisconsin has tried to do before, which is make it easier to vote and to encourage more voting. And this, even if it's a small restriction, depends on how you look at it. It makes it harder to vote for certain people, especially if you don't have an ID, and if it's hard for you to go out and get an ID. I mean, if you're a poor person in inner city Milwaukee who's trying to make ends meet, it might not be as easy for you to go out and get a state-issued ID as it is for someone else who has a day off here and there. So it's a big deal. In terms of what it does for the turnout in this state, even if it ratchets down turnout by, let's say, a few thousand votes among students or poor people in inner city Milwaukee, let's just take those two voting blocks, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It could be significant if you have a statewide election like we did in, say, 2000 and 2004. Which were very close presidential races, decided in the thousands of votes. If you shave off a little bit of turnout in those voting blocks, it could be very significant. Then again, we'll have a better idea in a couple years on whether or not this actually did drive out turnout. There are ways for people to go out and get IDs. I mean, if you don't have an ID, you can go out and have one basically furnished by the state of Wisconsin, paid for by the state of Wisconsin. They had to do that so that this wouldn't be a poll tax, essentially.
Yes.
And so there are ways for that to happen. And if you have a big push by groups that, you know, whether it be, you know, just voting groups, you know, like League of Women Voters mm-hmm. or something like that, or whether it be the Democratic Party or others, to just go out and make sure that everybody has IDs, you could offset that drop in turnout just by, you know, being active. Also, that's going to be something that could potentially be challenged in court, so we don't know what effect that could be. And one of the big issues in whether or not it would be successfully challenged in court is Wisconsin has fewer DMVs that are open for fewer hours than other states. So, for example, Indiana's voter ID law was held up as constitutional, but it has a lot more voter IDs. It's easier to get there. They're open more often. And that could be an issue if it goes to court.
It is hard for me to see a lot of voter fraud in the state of Wisconsin. Maybe I have missed some large stories, but it's hard to read this as anything other than a political decision. So inform me if I need to see it in a larger way.
In terms of voter fraud that's been found, yeah, you're right. I mean, in the 2008 presidential election, there was a voter fraud task force by Department of Justice and Milwaukee's district attorney, and they did not come up with, you know, they came up with, I think the number was in the teens of cases that they viewed as voter fraud. A lot of those were felons who were voting, which, you know, something like a photo ID requirement wouldn't necessarily fix. So that type of voter fraud just hasn't really, it hasn't been proven. One of the things you heard in the arguments by proponents of this bill as, you know, the legislative debate wound down was that part of the reason you can't find fraud is that you don't have this law, and that if somebody votes in your name without a requirement like this, it's hard to, you know, basically tabulate that on a statewide level, how many times it's happened. But you're talking about anecdotal evidence there, and this is you know, this is law now. And so, you know, whether or not that anecdotal evidence was enough to support a big change, you know, people are going to view that differently.
Thank you, Sean, so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio's state government reporter, our guest the first half hour. Craig Gilbert is joining us now, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we'll be looking at national stories. We'll ask him about the Herb Kohl seat, too, and who he sees expressing interest in that position. The Democrats winning a special House seat in a very Republican district in upstate New York. Did the press make too much of this, accusing Republicans of wanting to kill Medicare? And was that the reason that the Democrat won? Does that portend problems for Republicans in conservative districts who are trying to present an alternate version to Medicare? We'll look at that issue with Craig and many others as well. Our phone number remaining the same, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Craig.
Good morning.
How are you? Did you have a good holiday?
I did.
Yeah, it was nice here. 80.
A little steamy here.
Oh, were you in Milwaukee or Washington?
I was in Washington.
In Washington. It was steamy here, too, but it felt A-OK. Well, where should we start? Let's start with whether or not we're making the presses too much of this Democratic win in the Republican district in upstate New York. A lot of attention on that. Too much? Was it significant?
Well, no, I don't think it was too much attention. You know, it was the only election of its kind that we've had. There'll be another one, I think, in Nevada later this year. I mean, you have to be cautious because special elections aren't always predictive, we've seen historically, of the next election cycle. So keep that in mind. On the other hand, it was a Republican district that was carried by Democrats in a three-way race, of course, but there was no doubt that the debate over Medicare and the debate over Paul Ryan's budget played a role in the election. So it was a, you know, I think even a lot of Republicans at least privately, saw it as concerning, and it doesn't mean that the Republicans are going to lose the House in 2012. It doesn't even necessarily mean they're going to lose the debate over Medicare in 2012. I think that's, you know, still a little bit of an open question, but it does, I think, underscore the high-risk nature in a political sense of the Ryan budget, and it's certainly something that Republicans are trying to figure out how to get on top of between now and the next election.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this is, Mitch McConnell had some interesting things to say, reported yesterday, that trimming benefit programs like Medicare is really the only way to find the savings needed in order to make a serious dent in the government's debt. Do you think that he's counting on, and Republicans are counting on, that point being made again and again and again so that the public will eventually accept it?
I think they think that if they can, that the first step toward winning this argument for Republicans is persuading people that there is a crisis and that Medicare is unsustainable, and that there's a rationale for doing something big and fundamental to the program. So that is, you know, that's a big part of this debate we're going to have, is over how big the problem is and over how big the changes are or need to be in entitlement programs.
Mm-hmm. Herb Kolsey, what are you hearing about who might run?
Well, it's still pretty up in the air. I mean, on the Democratic side, I don't think the picture is going to be very clear for a while. I don't think Russ Feingold, who would be kind of the closest thing to an automatic in a Democratic primary, I don't think he's going to decide tomorrow. So he's taking his time. There are obviously other Democrats that are interested and eager to get in, maybe even whether or not he runs. And on the Republican side, we're kind of waiting to see whether Tommy Thompson is serious about running, setting up a really fascinating kind of dynamic where he has to fight conservatives, at least on the national level, who have shown, who have signaled that they are going to be very aggressive in challenging a Thompson candidacy from the right. And then you've got a lot of, you've got a lot of potential candidates on the Republican side who aren't necessarily that well known.
Why isn't Thompson conservative enough for people who are members of the National Club for Growth?
Well, because, he's always been a fairly practical politician who was, I think, driven by accumulating popularity, and that requires reaching out to independents and even conservative Democratic voters. He did that as a governor, and we saw the results. So even though he had conservative credentials as a governor, he also, worked with Democrats. He had to, because part of the time he was in office, there were Democrats controlled the legislature. So there are, and also, there's no doubt that the Republican Party has changed since he was a governor. I think that was one reason why he had so much trouble getting traction in his presidential campaign. The other was that he'd been out of office for a while, and I think he had trouble sort of defining himself in terms of what kind of Republican he was running as. Now, he could have the same problems running for the Senate, but he does have huge name ID and I think some residual popularity. But he does, there are going to be questions about his candidacy. And also, because he served as health secretary under President Bush, he's got a pretty voluminous record on some of these issues. And one of the things that Republicans accuse him of, some conservatives, the Club for Growth accuses him of, is of being at best insufficiently hostile to the Obama health care law.
Mm-hmm. The president just returned from a week-long European visit. Did anything substantial come from that, other than trying to get more Irish and Polish votes?
Well, I think for the purposes of domestic American politics, I don't think anything substantial came of it. I don't think the transatlantic relationship is any particular form of crisis. And so I think, a trip to Europe for an American president, unless there's a brewing or, a real burning crisis, is not going to be a terribly eventful, headline generating event.
Here's an email that's come in, and then we'll go to phone calls. Whatever happened to Barbara Lawton? Is there any thought to her running? for the Senate?
Well, her name has been tossed around, and again, the lists begin to get really long when you include all the people who've been mentioned by at least one person in the political world. And you've got, in the case of the Democrats, you've got people like Barbara Lawton, you've got people that have served in public office that are no longer in public office. You've got people that have run statewide and lost. You've got members of Congress, former members of Congress, state legislators. So the potential universe of candidates is pretty huge. But you know, most of those people that we talk about are not going to run, and a lot of them are not viable either because they would have trouble raising money or because they would just lack the political base that other Democrats have among Democratic primary voters.
We go to phone calls. Craig Gilbert is our guest this half hour. He is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Our number is 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for Craig, starting with Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Yesterday, Chicago Sun-Times had an article from a letter from a field organizer for Environment Illinois, and the organizer pointed out that right now coal-fired power plants are the single largest source of mercury, arsenic, and acid gases in the United States, and that 1 gram of mercury, this is interesting for sportsmen, is enough to contaminate an entire 20-acre lake. The most important part of the letter, though, talked about the impact on women bearing children, and they said that as a result of this, one in six women of childbearing age has enough mercury in her body to put her child at risk of learning disabilities, developmental disorders, and a lower IQ if she becomes pregnant. And the writer points out that the EPA is trying to improve the regulations on this so that they can protect us from this. Now, in contrast, of course, the Club for Growth and other Republican groups oppose regulation by the EPA, say it's too costly, et cetera, et cetera. And I just want to point out to the listeners that people have a clear-cut choice. If you don't want protection of the environment and you don't want protection of health and life, then don't vote Democrat.
Thanks for the call. You want to comment, Craig?
No, that's my area of expertise.
All right. Thanks, Jim, for the call. Michael in Milwaukee. Hi.
Morning. I would like Craig to comment on what I consider the media's, and some people could say the mainstream media is what they're called, over-coverage of people such as Sarah Palin and Donald Trump, people who should probably not get any mention at all in my estimation. But for one case in point, myself being a Vietnam veteran, I was terribly upset the way the media covered the Rolling Thunder ride to the wall, which is a yearly event, and they just twisted this whole thing and turned it into a complete Sarah Palin story. I found it quite upsetting. And I always say that I call Sarah Palin the Britney Spears of politics. Just when you think she's gone and forgotten, she somehow manages to resurrect herself.
Thanks for the call, Michael.
I think it's a very legitimate point. In fact, I living in the D.C. area, I watched the motorcycles roar in over the weekend, and I didn't go down to the Pentagon, and I wasn't part of that Sarah Palin scrum. But I do think it's a fair point. And, I mean, did anybody seriously think that Donald Trump was actually going to run for president? And if he did, would he be a serious candidate? No. And so, you know, there was a lot of ink spilled and airtime arguably wasted on Donald Trump, who was just not a serious candidate. And Sarah Palin, you know, would be a serious candidate in the sense that she would play a role politically, but likelihood of her running, I mean, who knows? And so we do spend a lot of time talking about people that may or may not run. I mean, the Washington Post had a story the other day about the fact that the governor of Texas was going to think about considering running.
Yes.
And so the bar in the political, in the national political media is pretty low for stories like that. You know, and it's, I don't think it raises issues of journalistic issues if we're talking about the political blogs that have a very targeted readership among political junkies. But I think if we're talking about the mass media, then I think you can argue that the time would be better served writing about candidates that we know are going to run, writing about the public policy debate, et cetera.
Well, why don't we?
Well, because in the case of Donald Trump and Sarah Palin, I mean, they are political celebrities, and so that's sort of a form of political celebrity journalism. And I think in the case, I mean, you know, it's whenever we talk about the media, we have to be careful about what media we're talking about. And if we're talking about cable, then cable tends to be driven by those kinds of factors, maybe more so than some media. But even, you know, online journalism is driven by online traffic, and so it's the same reasons why, you know, these are not new forces in terms of what shapes coverage is the pursuit of audience. And so I don't think it's a blanket indictment on the media, because I think there's a, you know, there is political media out there that is trying to cover these things in a serious way. And when it's all said and done, you know, we're going to have candidates that are actually candidates, and they'll be written about.
Yeah. It seems to me as though there are certain people, I've always wanted to do a show about the number of people you would just prefer not to hear about for the next couple of years because you've heard so much.
Yeah, we've all got our list.
We do, don't we? And yet they're still there every single day. And you'd think that a lot of people would agree that it's getting a bit tedious.
Well, and again, you know, you don't have to watch. You certainly don't have to. I mean, people who watch cable news get very frustrated unless they're true political junkies, because it provides a very distorted picture of what's going on in the world. But again, it's cable news. I mean, cable news has these channels have very small, you know, audiences as a percentage of the total electorate. So you pick, you know, everybody picks their sources of information, and there's a lot of information out there, and in most cases, I think the information that we have access to more information than we've ever had before. It just gets frustrating when, you know, when we see the kinds of situations we've been talking about where, you know, we're not getting the information we think where the media doesn't have the same priorities we have
right.
When it comes to what people should be hearing about.
Craig Gilbert is our guest, and we have lines open if you'd like to join the number, join the conversation. 800-486-8655 is our number. And the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We spent some of the last half hour, Craig, talking about concealed carry. I'd like to ask you to respond to this email. It's from Doug in DePere. I'm from Texas, he says. In Texas, it's mandatory to go through 24 hours of classroom training and passing a test. You also have to have a background check and be at least 18. Just letting people carry weapons without qualifications is too dangerous. Do you have a national perspective on this? Is Wisconsin just joining most of the union and allowing people to just carry guns wherever they want to without training?
Well, not without training. I mean, we were one of the outliers in terms of not having, not permitting concealed carry for the general public. So, in that sense, we're kind of joining the majority of states, or the great majority of states, in having laws like this. But as you just indicated, that like everything else, the rules vary vary a lot from state to state in terms of in terms of the nature of the permitting, in terms of requirements for training and eligibility. So, yeah, we would be something of an outlier, as I understand it, if we just allowed people to carry without any training, without any requirements. It's unclear whether that's what the legislation is going to end up doing, because I think we've reported that some Republican leadership indicating that it may change, and it won't just be a blanket concealed carry law.
Yeah, I think you were reporting over the weekend that at least training is part of what may be written.
Yeah, but I don't know where we're going to fall when it's all said and done in the spectrum of mm-hmm. these laws. But we were unusual in not having a concealed carry law before now.
Charlie in Superior. Hi.
Hello. I am amazed sometimes when I tune into WPR, I hear this self-righteous condemnation of either the media or the mainstream media. And then there's always this sort of a patting oneself on the forehead that we are not going to stoop to that low level. And yet, I haven't heard a thing about the USA Patriot Act that was extended by Congress the other day. President Obama was in France at the time, and he signed the bill before midnight Eastern time electronically from France. That's how important this was considered. And this should be the lead story on every network, especially NPR and WPR, yet I hear nothing about it, like it's not a big deal.
Well, you just heard something about it, Charlie. Thank you for calling. Craig?
Well, again, I mean, I think people, everybody has, you know, makes their own news judgments. And for this caller, you know, that's the most important story out there. It may not be the most important story out there for everybody. It's certainly a story. So, you know, I think it's people are perfectly entitled to second guess the news choices that different media make. I think it's problematic to generalize too much about the media as a single entity when it comes to making these judgments now more than ever, because the media is so fragmented and we're talking about such different kind of media dynamics and such different media outlets with different audiences. So I always shrink from blanket criticisms of the media because I never know who people are talking about. But I think it's perfectly legitimate for people to second-guess the news choices that media outlets make.
Thanks for the call. 800-486-8655. Let's go back to Republicans for a moment and go back to where we started with that Democrat winning a special House seat in a very Republican district. I'm wondering if Republicans are sitting down, having seminars, you know, having retreats, thinking about the direction of the party, because you've got, it seems to me, such a split. You know, you look at Tommy Thompson and Scott Walker, you look at Tim Pawlenty and Michelle Bachmann or Sarah Palin. Is there this deep examination of how moderate should we be? How conservative do we need to be? What do we stand for?
I don't know that I would say that that's going on right now. I think there's, you know, there are people that within the party that are, you know, that may think that the party has overreached politically, but I don't think that's a majority view within the party itself. I think, again, the party is in a different place than it was 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, and it is a more ideological party, and it's a more conservative party, and I think, I don't think people are, at this point, are talking about going back. I think they're hoping and believing that they can, that if there's, for example, a backlash against some of the things Scott Walker has done as governor of Wisconsin, that when the dust settles, if the economy in Wisconsin is okay, he'll be okay. I think that's the belief of people in the Republican Party in Wisconsin. And then, you know, on specific pieces of legislation, you know, we may find that members of the legislature, if they feel politically vulnerable, will peel back on some of that stuff. But I don't sense, again, this sort of wholesale soul-searching going on within the Republican Party. I think the Republican Party actually is fairly united, certainly when you look at House Republicans. You know, we've been posing this question forever about the Ryan budget. I mean, we didn't know before the Republicans passed a budget whether there would be these kinds of big entitlement changes in the budget. That there was a lot of suspense over that question, and lo and behold, all but four, it was in there, and all but four House Republicans in the country voted for it. That was pretty stunning, and again suggests a pretty high degree of unity within the Republican caucus. And even in the wake of the New York election, I think most Republicans on Capitol Hill have decided that their best course going forward is to try to, you know, is to try to win this debate rather than to walk away or distance themselves from the budget they passed. I mean, they passed this thing and they voted for it.
Mm-hmm. But in Wisconsin, Craig, the backlash has already been fairly significant, hasn't it? We're going to have a ton of recall elections.
Yeah, and again, this, depending on the outcome of those recall elections, this all may change. I mean, if the Democrats pick up two or three seats, certainly if they pick up three seats in the state Senate as a result of the recalls, that has a dramatic effect.
Yes.
Because it changes the composition of the government. But if it's, you know, if it's something less than that, then it remains to be seen what lessons Republicans will draw from this. And really, Republicans, you know, have kind of committed themselves to an agenda and a course of action. And I think at a certain point, you know, the one thing, I've been looking at a lot of polling data about governors, and I'll be writing about this tomorrow. When you look at Scott Walker's polling data, what really jumps out about it, he's not the most unpopular governor in the country. I mean, there are governors, including Republican governors, who are more unpopular than him. And the reason is they're just as unpopular among Democrats, but Scott Walker is incredibly popular among Republicans. And that's not necessarily true of John Kasich in Ohio and Rick Scott in Florida, for example, who have the same unpopularity among Democrats, maybe not quite the same, but they don't have this, they haven't mobilized and engaged Republicans the way Scott Walker has. Mm-hmm. So he's incredibly polarizing in terms of the difference between how he's perceived by Republican and Democratic voters, but at least he has a base that's solid and energized and mobilized, and I think he'll have that asset going forward. It may not be enough to win an election if he can't do better among independents, but it's a lot better than having the other side mobilized and having your side demoralized. So that's something to keep in mind going forward. We're incredibly polarized in Wisconsin, but one feature of that is that both sides are pretty jacked up and pretty kind of uniform. And so it's going to be a battle over independents and centrists, and that is not necessarily a battle the Republicans are winning at the moment, but there's a lot of time between now and November 2012.
Yeah. Thanks, Craig, very much.
Pleasure.
As always, Craig Gilbert, our guest this half hour of the program for All Things Political.